The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Robert Farrell, the Chief Squads and Service Officer at And Digital. Thanks, mate. Thanks for taking the time. As always, as I mentioned, everyone's incredibly busy, so I do appreciate it. Seems that we haven't quite had the tech catch up to our busy lives. If anything, it seems to have made us even more busy. So maybe we're at a point of inflection where eventually it will free us up and we eventually will be free to think things through instead of kind of, you know, manually do all of our tasks, which tend to be the things that make us the most busy.
Maybe there's some karma thing going on, and as we all get busier, someone else in the world is getting less busy.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Well, I do think that we're not far away from being at a point of real empowerment with technology. And I think that automation has a lot to do with it. I'm keen to talk with you a little bit as well, but like, you know, audio as well, like I'm a huge advocate of kind of synchronizing that with, you know, automating a lot of our tasks. If we can get to a point where, you know, that's practical, that's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, I think it is, and it is just becoming, I think what seems to change recently is it's now becoming so much more natural to be able to, you know, to give voice commands and get a sensible answer back, you know, at least enough of the time to keep assisting. It's kind of interesting how it's becoming so much easier to do that with voice.
Yeah. I'm a big advocate of it. And I was, I suppose I was quite bearish, really, because someone who I've met a good few times, and he's quite a prolific investor out in Silicon Valley. Like a couple of years ago, we spoke and he was going really heavily bullish on kind of audio-based software. And at the time, I thought it was interesting, but I was surprised at how bullish he was going on it. But now I kind of look back and I think that maybe he's got something there. I think he was definitely an early adopter as far as being bullish on that investment. But I think that there's certainly something to it. You know, there was an interesting kind of bit of data that came out not too long ago that was saying, you know, audio as far as purchasing power, that there isn't that trust factor there yet. So, you know, the it's nowhere near what it was to be expected from people purchasing using audio. And I think that's just a habit, really, isn't it?
I think there's a bit, well, we're definitely, there's a phase we're going through at the minute where at the very least, you know, audio is probably most powerful when it's integrated with other things. And I think I struggle right now to believe that for the foreseeable future, you know, audio will replace visual tools, whether that's web on a laptop or a iPhone or iPad. But it'll take some tasks away from those devices, and I think it will get more power as it integrates more with those things as well. And it is going to get better and better. But I'm pretty bullish about what voice will do, but I don't think there's any fear of it replacing one of the existing kind of connected tools.
Completely. Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting. I mean, I guess everything goes through this in some kind of path with, you know, the early adopters and people playing, you know, playing silly games with them, asking them quizzes, getting them to tell you jokes, you know, the kind of things you saw with the early on apps and a few, you know, very simple just reading content out type tools. And you saw the similar things, whether as web or with mobile, you see that same path where, you know, large organizations or kind of highly motivated tech individuals will pick up tools and they'll start playing with them and start throwing stuff out there, and everyone else will look in from the outside, or, you know, look from the outside and wonder what all the fuss about, and, you know, think that it won't affect them until a few years down the line when everything really starts to change. I think we're well down that line with voice.
Yeah, I think so. I just think it's a positive thing for the senses. I mean, I think, we become so obsessed and enamored by visuals, and visual seems to drive everything now. I think that I worry sometimes, I suppose worry is maybe the wrong word, but you know, with the level of interaction that we have with videos, the levels of content and how we're engaging with content, everything seems to be very short form, and it requires like a visual in order for it, anything to kind of make sense to people anymore, you know. And I think that there's something quite empowering about, you know, enhancing and using more frequently those kind of those listening and the audio senses, because I think the ability to listen and listen well, I think, is a massively positive thing, because you can really digest content at a much faster rate, at maybe at a higher level, I think, from audio. And it's an out there theory, but I do think that you know, we're kind of becoming very reliant on the kind of visual side of engagement.
No, I agree. I think at the very least, you know, when you think about the habit of, I don't know, even if it's just checking what's the weather. So you pick your phone up, you open it up, you flick on the weather app. But at that point, it's open, it's front of you. You might as well just check Twitter, check Facebook, check your emails, you know. And suddenly you're into a whole bunch of stuff. And I can't tell you the number of times I've picked my phone up to do something, looked at some messaging, and then had to switch the phone off again before I could remember what the hell it was I was originally going on the device for. So there is something neat about voice where it's instant. You ask the question, you get the answer, and you can carry on doing what you're doing. And it kind of at least gives you a fewer occasions when you need to pick up the phone.
Yeah, I clearly agree with it. I think it's I just think in general it's something that in the workplace as well. It's someone who's a good listener and is able to action what they've taken in. Is typically a high achiever. And that's an observation that I've made. And it's quite objective, I suppose, because I definitely haven't got any data to be able to kind of, you know, further expand on that assumption. But, you know, I can only speak from my experiences, that's typically been the case. Those that have been incredible listeners have typically achieved and overachieved who have been around me.
I think you're right. I mean, if you've got good active listening skills, you can you can better get under the skin of what other people are looking for and how to get, you know, how to find the win-win, because you're listening properly, you're understanding other people's motivations more clearly. So it is. I don't know. It's interesting. I hadn't really thought about whether voice tools was going to be a path back to, you know, better active listening. I need to ponder that one. It's quite an interesting concept.
Yeah. I'm glad it's made you think. I rarely do that. Or maybe it's just because people don't listen to me.
It could be that. You never know. Yeah, it's because everyone's on the phone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Looking at the phone.
There is something, because I think there's a... it's interesting how, you know, we try at the dinner table with kids to you know, no devices, not allowed. But you do, you know, there's those moments when it's a really hard habit to crack, when you want to find out the weather, or you need to check something that's related to the conversation you're having. And when you know that you're not allowed to pick your phone up because that's the table rule, it's interesting. We kind of are figuring out, actually, is it okay to ask Alexa? You know, does that count as having a device? And it kind of seems at the minute that it is okay. You know, you can ask the question, you get a quick answer, and you can move on, and no one's sat there carrying on looking at their mobile. So it definitely makes some things easier. Whether we need to answer that question there or then, maybe that's a whole other question.
Yeah, I think so. I just think that there's something about the way that we're kind of engaging and interacting and or even kind of educating ourselves at the moment. I don't know. Maybe I'm overthinking it, and probably am, but maybe it's probably a healthy trait. I just think that there seems to be sometimes just a lack of substance with things. And, you know, I think it's just a trait that I don't think is necessarily, you know, positive. And I think it's advantageous in some ways, certainly for young people starting out their careers, if you can kind of beat that stereotype and become a good listener. I think it's a massive opportunity for people like that, and relatively simple thing to kind of pursue. But just in general, it might not be the best way to kind of help us think and ponder things, which, you know, with the potential rise of automation and artificial intelligence and these sort of things, you know, the empowering thing about those is that they are going to alleviate the manual duties that, you know, are monotonous and don't allow us that time to actually think things through and think things through at a higher level. You know, you have to have that ability.
I'm actually pretty positive about where technology's going and what it does. Because, you know, on one side, if you look at what my parents' generation did with TV, so, you know, the main, you know, user technology in every household was the TV. And if I think about the amount of time that I was allowed to and did watch TV, you know, pointless black and white films from the 50s on Saturday afternoons and sport and just every, I watched so much TV and my parents watched so much TV. I kind of think, I don't know whether really en masse, you know, this new technology, it's a bit more broken up. Okay, you're not sat in a family room watching a single device, but when people were in those situations, they were still, you know, monged out, looking at a single screen, not really focusing on each other, not listening and talking to each other. Whereas I think what technology is doing, at least, is connecting people more effectively, is creating more conversations. And I think, you know, even if you worry about your kids playing Fortnite, you know, on the PlayStation or whatever, the interesting thing is they're more often interested in doing it. Or certainly mine are more interested in doing it if they can stick their headphones on and play with their friends. And so the conversation and the chat and the collaboration that they're getting from using that tech, it is. Okay, maybe it's not a perfect substitute for going out and playing on the street with your friends, but the way we live today, it's not practical for the kids to be going out on the street because they don't live anywhere near their friends. So as long as you've got some kind of a balance and as long as you're using the tech for connecting and collaborating and communicating, I'm not so worried about where it'll take us.
Yeah. No, I think I'm in agreement that I am optimistic about things. I think for me it's just the engagement level. I think I think more about the way we engage with content is something for me that I would question. But no, I mean, there's no doubt that, like, I think it's incredibly empowering, and the access to information is incredible. It's just, you know, how we're digesting that and the substance that we're getting from that. Because I think that's like, it's like even in the news, isn't it? You know, everything's like, a lot of things are opinion and a lot of things are, you know, built to suit. So it's, you know, how we're digesting that information and taking things is, and questioning things is, I think, what needs to be a little bit more of a focus on maybe how we're educating people. That would be the only thing that I would question.
No, you're right. Yeah, I think the content that it tends to fragment opinion. So it's I'm not even sure it's just, you know, creating you know, two perspectives, you know, right or left in political terms. I think there's, you know, a very small group can form a very tight set of opinions around something. And it can be very, very different from, you know, 100, 200,000 other different groups. So yeah, the opinions are much more fragmented and don't necessarily get challenged appropriately. But I don't know. I'm not sure how we fix that challenge.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, like I say, I may or may not be. That's just the only reason why I felt it might be compelling to bring up, you know, the ideas of just the different ways that we engage with content could help. So it's like, you know, for example, you talking to someone, and I feel like I have a good sense for when someone's lying to me, right? in a verbal way. So maybe that those senses are more heightened when it's in a kind of audio space rather than, you know, being able to read something with a mixture of visuals. I don't know whether you can get away with it in the same way, you know, because there's no song and dance to kind of detract your attention.
No, that's true. Yeah, well, I love the idea. It'd be great, wouldn't it, if you had a Alexa who could have a, you know, have a, you know, underlying tone based on on whether she was feeling guilty about the rubbish that she was spouting, or, you know, enthusiastic about something. Oh, that's an interesting, you know, maybe that's another feature of where voice needs to go next, is how does it start communicating with tone and feeling, and passion.
She has. I think she's got some passion in there already. When I'm asking her to put on, you know, a bit of Barry White or whatever, you know.
Well, there's definitely, you know, there's a lot of passion when she gets things wrong.
Sport
invective heading her way. So
I think there's some sass in there as well. Whenever I ask her something she doesn't know, or I ask her a stupid question. I think there's definitely a sense of sass in there, or maybe that's just me.
I think you're probably right. And I think actually they need to carry on building that sense of fun in, because the more little surprises and Easter eggs you get from saying things and asking random questions, and, you know, because I discovered a couple of months ago that you can ask her to give you a round of applause, or to cheer for you, and, you know, you can do silly things like that. But I think it just, there's things like that will increase the usage and the reliance on the tool. I wonder how tone and accent and, yeah, I saw something the other day. It was somebody built an AI algorithm to replicate Trump's voice. I don't know if you saw this.
No, I didn't. No.
So basically, they were the two things. They had an actor reading a script, trying to pretend to be Donald Trump, and then an algorithm reading the text as if it was Donald, using, you know, recreating Donald Trump's voice. And by a long way, the algorithm sounded exactly like Donald Trump, and the actor was clearly an actor.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of interesting where that takes you. So because you look at then, you know, the ability to synthesize specific voices in these voice tools, I'm sure isn't that far away.
Yeah. Well, I've seen some stuff which is, like, I think probably heavily driven from the conspiracy theory community, where they're able to kind of reenact, you know, politicians. I think they had, like, JFK and, you know, Trump and Obama, and predominantly, like, US presidents, I think it was. And, you know, they were able to reenact their voices and how they were saying things. And they could essentially make them say whatever they wanted to. And it was incredible how realistic this was. Like, incredible. The conspiracy theory community got all over that one, and were kind of went a bit wild with it. But yeah, it's amazing, like, you know, the tech. And I think that's, like you say, I think with you know, identifying these things, it might become harder and harder, which is a fascinating problem. It's just a fascinating place where we're in. I don't know whether it's necessarily the best use of those tools, but it's nonetheless, it's still fascinating.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I guess a lot of these things, and maybe they are becoming so advanced it's too hard, but, you know, I suspect that there were a lot of people who were worried about photocopiers and how that would mean that, you know, proving your identity with a signature was no longer safe, because everyone was going to be able to photocopy your signature onto things. And, you know, I think there's gradually, as we get used to new technology, we'll find new ways of managing identity and dealing with issues. And there will always be a bit of fraud around the edges, you know, as there always has been.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, that's people that drives that. I don't think it's technology that drives it.
No, of course not. Exactly. It's always going to be there, isn't it? That's why we have security teams and stuff and such. I wanted to ask, you know, obviously you're and digital now, they're doing incredibly well, by the way, just exploding. But you know, obviously, you know, kind of work a lot with on client site and such, with the technology and obviously fully digitizing companies and you know, of all sorts of nature, is there something that you're getting a sense for, or at least the company's getting a sense for, which is kind of consistent with, you know, what clients' vision is digitally, and how far in advance people are starting to look? Is there any kind of trends that you're starting to see with how they want to become digitalized, and any kind of specific technologies that people seem to be particularly fascinated by?
I think there's, I guess, the kinds of clients, so we more often work with large enterprise clients who are you know, fighting the battle to keep their market share, keep their margins against all the, you know, the tech startups. Mm. So it's about how we help them adopt all these new technologies that are coming down the line so fast. So there's kind of two parts to that. So one of the themes is about how these companies work and how they can get their teams and their businesses oriented to be able to move quicker and adopt these new technologies much, much quicker, rather than the 2-3 year big programs and the, you know, the multi-year re-platform projects that need to happen. So there's a lot of, so one theme is definitely this this ability to move away from project based work into product and really, really kind of having a, you know, a long lived product with a well enabled team who can continually change things and keep things fresh and adopt new technologies and just be much quicker in the market. So that's one clear theme that's happening. I think there's a couple of other areas that you can, I mean, that you can see. I think it looks a little bit and feels a little bit like it did with mobile, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And particularly for voice and for AI or machine learning, so probably narrow AI. And I think those are two areas that seem to be moving closer. You know, there's lots of practical examples about how those tools are now being used in larger companies or with government organizations or multinational institutions. And so it's becoming easier to imagine how to adopt, or that there is a need to adopt those kind of tools. Mm. So yeah, definitely voice and machine learning of some sort are probably the two things.
Yeah,
it still feels that now. I mean, I think every business is different. You know, some have got voice tools, you know, got voice solutions in place on Alexa or Google. Some are just pilot, you know, looking at building stuff internally. But I would have said, I think where lots of the enterprises that I've seen are is that they haven't yet got to a point that they have with mobile, where, for example, they've got a mobile team. You know, everyone's had a web team for 15, maybe 20 years, and maybe lots of organizations have now had internal, you know, their own mobile teams for a few years now, rather than just use agencies. But I'm not seeing many organizations that have quite got to a place where they have a voice team focusing on that, on those particular channels.
Yeah.
And similarly, you know, the use of AI is a little bit spotty at the minute. There's no team who is focused on machine learning, artificial intelligence, or rarely teams that do that. There are bits of other teams that you know, that help out or try little projects or try tools and techniques. But it's not yet, both voice and AI are not tools that are regularly used kind of in most scenarios.
Yeah.
But I think those are the two that are kind of work in progress right now.
Is there any questions as well around like kind of developing and getting the return on investment for a lot of these technologies? Is that like a kind of a question that happens enough, or is it a question that possibly doesn't happen enough about with regards to that?
Yeah, I'm not sure that is happening enough at the minute. You know, I think,
really?
There's an early set. Well, actually, it's different probably for voice, between voice and AI, because I think there's a belief that probably AI will be able to optimize something and save some money or improve conversion rates or something, if only people can work out what data to push in and what question to ask it. So there's a kind of a hard question about how do you make AI work, but probably high confidence that it can definitely add some value somewhere in the business. I think voice is a little bit more difficult. So like I was saying before, I think, you know, it's voice for the moment is not going to replace other devices, but it will become much more embedded in our lives, and it will become, you know, a well-loved and useful tool that we all want to use. And so expectations of voice from customers is going to grow. But how does a company gain any value from it? How does it, you know, what use cases, you know, what user journeys are going to be supported by using voice? And I think that's a more difficult question for lots of organizations, and the value coming out of it is much less obvious. I think the good news, though, is that actually on voice, you know, the tech, when you look at the tools and that Amazon and Google have out there for integrating and using these things, it's really not difficult. You know, the cost of entry to do this kind of stuff on voice in particular is really not that very high. You know, you can use your existing development team, you can use most of your existing processes, and there's a couple of additional tools you might want to put in place, but it's very low cost. The main challenge on voice is really trying to understand, what do you want to do with it? Why do you want to do it? How is it going to help customer? How is it going to help the business? If you can figure that out, actually getting and implementing stuff is really quite easy.
Yeah. Does it ever surprise you whether those questions, I mean, obviously you don't have to mention any names on this, but does it surprise you at times the kind of the lack of urgency on things like that, you know, developing, you know, kind of an ROI on certain techs? Does it ever really surprise you?
I think it probably has done in the past. I'm not sure it surprises me very much anymore. I'm more often surprised when someone actually is racing ahead and doing something, because it's quite normal for, you know, large organizations to be slow at working out where the value might be from a new tool. You know, maybe it requires one or two competitors to be doing something that gets noticed by the exec, at which point they throw a question down to IT and ask them why they haven't done X, Y, and Z, and when can they do it, and can we have a pro? You know, there's quite a slow seeping in into the consciousness before some large organizations really start doing stuff. A lot of large organizations start adopting new tech. So I don't think it's that unusual. I think it does leave people behind in some ways. But then again, you know, it's also... it's not impossible, I think, to play catch up with a lot of these things. And take mobile as a good example. There are lots of enterprises that have fantastic mobile apps that didn't, you know, weren't mobile first. You know, retailers and or even online retailers that were web first are now got fantastic mobile capability. So you can make good progress very quickly. Mm. But trying to figure out the time it takes to figure out why you should do something and what you should do with it it can be frustrating in large businesses.
Yeah.
Because, you know, often there'll be a lot of people in those businesses will know exactly what value will come from this, and they'll understand the implications of not doing something. But sometimes it's just, you know, change is quite hard in these big organizations. You need to understand the return. You've got limited capital to invest in things. And when you can, you know, take a large retailer, if you're on a growth mode, if you can roll out 10 new stores and you know exactly how much that's going to cost you and you're pretty sure what the return is and how quickly those stores will break even, that's a really easy business case to get signed off. You go to them and say, let's spend £1 million on doing voice for the next 12 months. You know, there's no, where do you go with that? How do you convince anyone with a revenue business case? Or even a cost saving in business case is much harder than doing more of the same stuff.
Agreed, mate. Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And it's almost, do you think it's unprecedented in a way, the way that we approach technology and the investment in technology? Because I always think about maybe when manufacturing was actually existed in the UK. Remember those days. You know, you look at the plant costs, the machine costs and everything. Everything was massively accounted for. And I know it's not it's not an apples to apples case study here, but, you know, the way we approached any kind of investment in machinery, which would have been kind of innovation, you know, before kind of computers and software existed, everything was massively accounted for. And I just feel as though, with technology, everything, it's almost as though, you know, from an executive perspective, there is a misunderstanding about it. And we're in a place where people are investing massively without even maybe fully understanding the tech. That's the sense I get, really, from it. I mean, because it wouldn't have happened in the machine days, right? It wouldn't have invested in it unnecessarily.
I don't know. I think what you'll probably find is if we had access to the history books, what you'd probably find is some crazy entrepreneurs who spent tons and tons of money on buying new machinery, yeah. didn't have the market, didn't understand it, went bankrupt, and someone else picked the machinery up at very low cost and made a success of it. So I reckon you'll find some of those. And I think you find that in every bust, you know, every boom and bust, or every, you know, tech cycle, there are companies who will overinvest and then never land the business, companies who will underinvest and go out of business, and a whole bunch of other companies that will sit in between those two and somehow be successful. And I'm reasonably sure that that pattern is followed through from the various phases of kind of industrial revolutions and through kind of the last few phases of tech revolutions.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, probably right. Definitely.
It does when you look at it. It can still look crazy in some angles, but there are lots of organisations who are actually a little bit too slow in making some investments because they are so fixed on looking at short-term returns rather than planning out what a 3 to 5 year return might look like on some initial investments.
Yeah, true. Well, I won't keep you too much longer, mate, but one thing I just wanted to kind of clear up now as well is your job title. Rather fascinating. So, you know, I think it's really interesting, but, you know, try and explain the job title and maybe closer to what people might, you know, assume the function to be.
Sure. So it was really trying to cover off a couple of things. We wanted it not to be a bog standard MD managing director type role title. I look after one of our business units, and there are two main focuses. There are squads, which are that's the teams that we have inside. We call our business units a club. Inside that club, we have squads, which are our team members who are our Andes who work for clients, who do the professional services job. They go and work with clients and help deliver products. So I need to make sure I'm looking after our squads. And then the other part, of course, is the service and looking after our clients, hence the title Chief Squads and Service Officer. So it's making sure I've got at the top of my mind those two areas of focus. We can't be successful with our clients if I haven't got great engagement and amazing people. So I have to look after the squads in order to be able to deliver the right kind of service. So that's the thinking. Probably closest to the role would be, maybe a managing director of a line of business.
I like it. Robert, great way to finish, mate. I think we've nailed the 30 minutes pretty much on the nose. So thank you, mate, for taking the time.
That was a great conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.